talking to this work before it was, probably before it was written even, to a friend of mine, Ephraim Steinberg. His response was something like, "My God, you want to write a paper about Bohmian mechanics and weak values and Bayesianism, and you expect to have a referee, you know, accept it." Luckily, eventually it found a home. And referees that accepted or were braided enough in the end to give up. So most of what I'm going to talk about, you can read about in this journal here.
It's significant that it's the new journal of physics.
Higher impact factor than Phys Rev A. Okay, so this is an outline of all the things which I hope to cover. So for those who aren't... Who are looking for motivation and explanation, I'm going to begin with that. So I'm talking about why we would consider hidden variables, what some of the problems are, and a bit about Bohmian mechanics, what it's like. Then I'm going to get on to sort of the original work, which is weak values in Bohmian dynamics, weak values in Bohmian kinematics, and I'll explain what the difference between these are. Then I want to get onto something which doesn't really have anything to do with weak values, but this is where the Bayesianism comes in, and I think I've got perhaps some interesting things to say about that, and I'll finish by talking about remaining problems or directions. Okay, so, yes?
Well, I just noticed you've got a slide explicitly on Bohmian mechanics there, but you don't have anything specifically on weak values, so I'm going to ask ahead of time, are you going to be slipping that one under the rug?
I'm going to give an introduction to that in this section. So this is a fairly long section, so I will explain what a weak value is. Yeah, okay. I think I'm going to be aided in this first section especially by Eric's talk this morning, which obviously came out of discussions that we've had. So I'll be using some of the same terminology. There might be a few differences, I'm not sure. But what I want to just start by is talking about the difference between operations versus explanation, so operationalism versus something else. So the orthodox quantum theory, I would say, is an operational theory. And that means that it's basically about making statements about temporally ordered macroscopic events like preparation procedures, measurement procedures, and measurement outcomes. And the theory is just relations between those given by probabilities such as this one here. So an operational theory offers no explanation or interpretation of this probability. It just says this is the probability. Okay. So as soon as you put anything else into your theory other than these macroscopic things, then you're dealing with the hidden variables theory. Okay. So this is the sense that I'm using the term hidden variables. It's anything else. So obviously whatever else you put there is operationally superfluous. It doesn't tell you anything. Doesn't change your operational probabilities, and so that's the sense in which it's hidden. Okay, and so I'll call a hidden variable interpretation as being any model or mechanism which offers some extra explanation using hidden variables like that. Okay, so specifically, this is what a hidden variable interpretation would look like. So I'd start by saying, well, I have some set of possible values for my hidden variables. And for a given preparation procedure, there is going to be correspondingly some probability measure on that space. So basically the probability for a certain hidden variable arising given a preparation procedure. And so on the basis of that, I specify in my theory then the probability of getting outcome A given a setting, little a, given a preparation procedure and a lambda. And that better agree with my operational probabilities, so they should obey this relation. So a non-trivial hidden variable interpretation is one for which this lambda actually does something in this conditional probability. Okay, I could consider trivial hidden variable interpretations, and in fact, physicists do this all the time. They use orthodox quantum theory to calculate things, but then they use words to describe what's going on, like they say the photon propagated from here to there, okay, and that's a hidden variable in their theory. But they don't actually use that notion to calculate anything, so it's a trivial hidden variable interpretation. But I'm obviously interested here in non-trivial hidden variable interpretations. So why would you consider them? And I think there are probably more, but here are three reasons. So one is just to offer an explanation of the probabilities that appear in the operational theory. Secondly, to explain the existence of those things which were just assumed in the operational theory, which is to say, you know, macroscopic observers who are able to, you know, prepare things and make measurements and observe their outcomes. So things like that. And thirdly, and this is, this is the, you know, more speculative one, is that it might possibly suggest research towards a theory that could supersede quantum theory. Okay, so I'm going to begin, as I said, to talk about problems with hidden variables, and one which people are probably going to think about straight away is violation of locality, whoops, by which I mean, they've spoiled my joke already. So Eric talked about this morning, that if we consider two distant parties and with space-like separated measurements and results, then what Bell showed is that there does not exist any explanation of those probabilities satisfying this assumption here of local causality, that the probability of this outcome should only depend on things local to A, including perhaps the hidden variables, but not including Bob's measurement setting or outcome B. So in other words, there are, again to use that, the term, there are some quantum phenomena that cannot result from local causes. And of course, saying that using the quantum state as our description doesn't make any difference to that that interpretation. Okay, so here we go. So yes, with apologies to Lucien, F locality. The why do I say this? Because basically the only way you can avoid this violation of local causality is to be strictly operational. Okay, it's not the situation, and this is what I was getting at on the previous slide. So for example, if I put in a quantum state there or whatever, or if I just treat orthodox quantum theory, it's not the case that this respects local causality, okay? It's just that the only way you can avoid it is just by refusing to talk about concepts which enable the formulation of the, you know, this concept of local causality. So in other words, you have to refuse to talk about hidden variables in order to avoid this. Then you'll be able to avoid this concept, and then you won't be able to say anything about it. But if you want to say something definite about it, you have to consider hidden variables to begin with. So this is why, you know, Bell, for instance, argued that it's not that non-locality is a problem in hidden variables models, but rather it's a feature of orthodox quantum theory which can only be revealed by considering hidden variable models. Okay. So that is not, therefore, I'm arguing, not the problem particularly with hidden variable interpretations, but there is certainly a problem, and that's non-uniqueness. And this is because there are infinitely many hidden variable interpretations which must be non-local, as we know, which are compatible with experience, well, compatible with quantum mechanics and what we've observed. And so, for example, there's this article by Guido and Dixon, and a little bit more recently in the same journal, myself and Jay Gambetta published an even more general formulation. So there are, you know, infinitely many, it's a large sort of infinity which describes the possible hidden variable interpretations which one might consider. So it's a very, very non-unique sort of system. So you could just say, if you're interested in hidden variables, that's just the way the world is. There are infinitely many possible explanations, and we'll just move on from there and say, well, one of them was right, but you know, we'll never find out, and who cares? But I think there are reasons for not saying that, not adopting that attitude, but just trying to go a bit further and come up with a unique hidden variable interpretation, or at least a smaller set to consider on physical grounds, okay? And so justifications for this are, so one, it would aid pedagogy. That is, if one wanted to teach this as a serious interpretation of quantum mechanics, then obviously having one particular model to teach is going to be infinitely preferable to having infinitely many models to teach. Second, and I genuinely believe this, that having the right model could aid intuition into quantum phenomena. And thirdly, and this is the speculative one, that I think it again, if you have, you know, the right one in, or whatever, you know, an interpretation that's preferred on physical grounds, this might help point to a theory beyond quantum theory, if there is such a thing. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about Bohmian mechanics, and probably everybody knows. So, as Ward talked about this afternoon, it's called by many other names because it originally goes back to De Broglie, but I'm going to call it Bohmian mechanics, for better or for worse. Okay, so I'll begin with the simplest case, which is single particle Bohmian mechanics, and just a scalar particle with a scalar wave function. Then the theory is just very simple. It says that the Bohmian hidden variable is the particle's position, x, and this obeys this equation here. So it's just a first-order differential equation in time. This is a velocity field over three-dimensional space, which is given by this j, which is a current, divided by p, which is a probability. And these things are defined in this manner. So this p is, of course, the standard quantum mechanical probability density in space. And this j is, in fact, the standard probability current, or flux. And these things, put these two things together, obey this equation, which shows that, you'd expect for a probability to be conserved. And what that means is that, with this formula for the probability, that if that's true at some time t, then it will be true at a later time t because of this continuity equation here. Okay. It's a solution of that equation. Anyone who hasn't seen it, here's just a picture of Bohmian trajectory, so you can, I misspelled that, but anyway, you can get an idea. So this is for a two-slit experiment. This is time this way, this is x, so this is a one-dimensional problem, clearly. It shows some of the characteristics that you don't have crossings of trajectories, clearly, because you have a velocity field. So in one dimension, clearly you can't get a crossing. And if it was a two-dimensional problem and I was just looking at a projection onto one dimension, you could see crossing. But in whatever your dimension of your configuration space is, your trajectories never cross. And you can see that, you know, the trajectories don't follow straight lines even when there's no potential. And so what you get is collections of particles at these points here, which correspond to the maximum of your interference pattern. And so basically it reproduces everything that quantum mechanics does, but it says that particles have real positions. Okay, so that was single particle Bohmian mechanics, but to describe the world we have to be much more general than that. And so this is one way of doing it. So Ward talked about possible ways. This is one of his ways, and I think it's closest to what Bohm talked about. I think is that for the universe, you have to deal with now an infinity-sized vector, which is going to include the three positions of all the particles in the world, and also the values of all the quantized gauge fields at every point in space. So it's an enormormously large vector. But the basic equation looks very similar. You still have a velocity field in this enormous infinite dimensional configuration space. And the nth component of the velocity field is given by this expression here. So this doesn't look really the same as the expression which I gave before. But nevertheless, you can show that it is the same. And this is the way I like to write it down. It's a bit different from what other people do, but you'll see. I think this is the most elegant way to think about writing it down in a general case. So the point is that we're not assuming that it has to be a scalar particles or anything. So these wave functions here. So this is the wave function of the universe now. Everything can include spins, for example. Okay, and it's all taken care of by writing the expression in this way. Some comments about this. So first, it's clearly does give rise to non-locality, or has the potential to give rise to non-locality, because this the derivative for this coordinate for some particular n is going to depend upon obviously the values of all the other coordinates. So the peculiarity is that the way in which it does it is not dependent on, in an obvious way, on the separation between the particles. And so you can get non-local effects in that way. So this is what I was getting at before, that this is where Bell was saying that this is actually a merit of the theory, that it brings out this non-locality so explicitly that it cannot be ignored. So he saw that as being a merit of hidden variable interpretations, and this one in particular. So how does that relate to orthodox quantum theory? The answer is that orthodox quantum theory emerges from Bohmian mechanics. And the basically the way it happens is that quantum states, I suppose I don't have to stay behind there all the time, do I? So quantum states for subsystems emerge from Bohmian mechanics in the sense that let's consider a toy model of the universe that consists only out of an observer O and a system S, and let's say that the observer is able to assign to the system a pure state. Then how does that emerge out of Bohmian theory? Well, the answer is that pure state for the system would be proportional to the eigenstate for the observer's position, XO, acting on the wave function for the whole universe. So it's sort of a bit like as if the observer, had measured herself, to be in a position eigenstate X naught and collapsed, therefore, the state of the rest of the universe, the system, into some other state. But of course, that measurement and that collapse never happens. It's just this X naught is what we regard as being the real position of the observer according to the Bohmian mechanics. So that's the difference. Is that this is the this is an unambiguously defined quantity in Bohmian mechanics, because this thing, the position of the observer, or the configuration, I should say, of the observer, is a real thing made up of particles and field, etc. Which is known, and the point is that we imagine that, essentially then this is no different from classical theory. Observers are made up of, particles, etc. So it's quite plausible to imagine that the observer can know her own configuration to some approximation just by introspection. And that therefore the observer can, has knowledge of this X naught, and so can infer this state of the subsystem. So I'll comment on the nature of this subsystem here. I'm going to call this an operational state, and I think this is following Lucien's terminology, but he can correct me if I'm wrong. So in addition to that, I haven't said anything about the configuration of the system, because that is something which is also going to be, exists in Bohmian mechanics. There's also an unknown position of the system, which is going to be guided by this state of this operational state of the subsystem. But in a sense, that's not essential to the existence of this state. That's sort of an extra part of the theory which happens. But given that there is, the observer in standard quantum Bohmian mechanics, the observer would assign a distribution to that configuration of the subsystem, which is also in terms of this operational state for that subsystem.
Howard,
yeah?
Are all these positions defined relative to, or?
I don't know if the short answer is that they're absolute. Whether one can, presumably, if one can formulate quantum theory in a relation way, one could also define all of these positions relationally as well. But I don't know if there's any literature on that.
Is there something special about observers there, since they apparently know their axes, whereas you can't know the axes of anything else?
No, there's not meant to be anything special about observers. I guess you could ask in a classical physics theory, how is it that you and I can know our configurations, but a shoe can't? I think questions like that are not peculiar to this interpretation of quantum mechanics. So I thought it might be interesting to make some comments about, because people have talked about this a bit, I missed Rob's talk, but nevertheless, I thought it might be interesting to make some comments about epistemic states versus operational states. So a point with this theory is that psi s this is not an epistemic state for the position of the system. Okay. So that's quite unlike the case in Rob's toy theory, where you have an ontic state for the subsystem, and the epistemic state, or which is actually identical to the operational state in Rob's theory, is just essentially like a probability distribution over that. So that's not the nature of this quantity in Bohmian mechanics. It's an operational state in Lucien's term, but it's not an epistemic state of the subsystem. And moreover, Lucien can, I wrote this down from memory, so Lucien, please correct me if I'm wrong, that there's, Lucien proved this on what he called an ontological excess baggage theorem for quantum mechanics, which is roughly that the number of distinct epistemic states, which of course must be at least as large as the number of distinct operational states, this applies to, calling them epistemic states here, this is Lucien's terminology, I think, presumes that we're talking about a hidden variables interpretation of quantum mechanics, and that we're imagining that that we have some hidden variable interpretation. So epistemic states then are just probability distributions over hidden variables. So the theorem is that the number of distinct epistemic states basically is infinitely greater than the dimensionality of the space of the operational states. No, I think it would be the dimensionality of the space of the ontic states is infinitely greater than the dimensionality of the space of the operational states. But the number of the distinct epistemic states, I think, is equal to the dimensionality of the ontic state space. Is that correct, Lucien?
If there's
a
certain number of distinct ontic states, it's much bigger than the dimensionality of the space of the operational states.
So of course there are infinite number in general.
If you said you allow any epistemic state, any valid probability distribution on the space of epistemic states, then you'd have one parameter for every ontic state. So I think I said that wrong. If you allow any distribution on the space of ontic states,
yes,
then you'd have one parameter,
yes,
for every ontic state.
That's right.
And so the number of parameters would be much greater than the dimension,
yes,
of the operational states. But if you imagine that there might be a restriction on the epistemic states,
yes,
then you have many fewer epistemic states, despite the fact that you have an infinite number of ontic states.
Yes.
So I think it is better to say the number of distinct ontic states.
Okay, so I guess Lucien wasn't considering an epistemic restriction. So if you prefer, you can say that the dimensionality of the space of ontic states is infinitely greater than the dimensionality of the space of operational states.
Not the dimensionality of the space of ontic states, the number of ontic states.
That's not the same. Okay, sorry, you're right. The number of ontic states. You're right. The dimensionality of the space of operational states is infinitely greater than the number of ontic states.
Yes, but it's the other way around.
Yes, the number of ontic states is infinitely greater than the dimensionality of the space of operational states. Right. Okay. Yes. So, Okay. So, again, I just thought this is a true fact about quantum mechanics. If you have no epistemic restrictions, then you can also, I think the way which I said it there is also true. And I think this is basically the way that Lucien said it. So the only comment I wanted to make about that is that, given that we have, this is still true, obviously, then with these operational states as they appear in Bohmian mechanics, I should point out, when I have things in blue, that means things that I haven't necessarily thought through completely thoroughly. I just thought that there's some way to understand this in terms of the fact that these different operational states here are defined in terms of the ontic states for the rest of the universe, and maybe it's related to the fact that, and this is a consequence of non-locality, that the rest of the universe is infinitely bigger than any little subsystem, so perhaps that's somehow related to this infinite difference here. But as I said, that's not necessarily well thought through. Okay, so that's my little summary of Bohmian mechanics. And now I want to talk about the new work. But first, just getting back to the problem with Bohmian mechanics, getting back to the non-uniqueness problem, even if you consider, you know, a theory which is defined by these equations here, but without this definition of what J is, so you've already then severely restricted your possible hidden variable interpretations. If you do that, there's still an infinite amount of arbitrariness, because, so to quote D'Otto and Garrardi, there are infinitely many expressions for J that obey this continuity equation while still satisfying all possible physically meaningful requirements one can put forward to them. That was their conclusion. So this seems a bit odd, because there's this standard probability current that's been around since 1926, so you think it must have some justification, you know, maybe some operational definition, but it, as far as I can tell, it hasn't until now. Now, the basic problem is why there's not a straightforward operational definition is obviously that the probability current relates to the motion of a particle at a particular position x, and of course, velocity and position cannot simultaneously be measured. However, the idea which I had was to turn to the theory of weak values, which I will go over. So that was introduced by Harnoff, Albert, and Weidmann in 88. And I guess this notion has a long history in quantum mechanics in providing, you know, what's arguably the best operational definitions of concepts that don't have meaning in orthodox quantum mechanics. So here's the one or two.
I have a question about that last sentence. Does the use of which there mean that weak values have the proud history and not Albert?
Yeah. Yes.
I just wanted to be sure.
Yes. Yes. No. Because it's not. They're not the only ones who've done work on it. Okay, so weak values. So first of all, I want to define weak measurement, because that's the basic concept behind it. And to define weak measurement, first I'll define strong measurement. Okay, so strong measurement is the one that everyone's familiar with in quantum mechanics, where you make a projective measurement of some observable, you get a result, and it projects the system into the corresponding eigenstate. So this is creates a big disturbance in the system. The idea is that if you make a measurement which is not as precise, an imprecise measurement of some quantity, then you can disturb the system less. And in particular, a weak measurement of some observable A is one which is an arbitrarily imprecise measurement, and hence has an arbitrarily small disturbance of the system. And for those who are familiar with positive operator valued measures, I can write down one which describes a weak measurement. For those who aren't, just don't worry about these details. But basically, yeah, here is an example of a weak POM, which will if I take the square root of that and work out what it does to the system, it does almost nothing. Okay, in the limit that this sigma is an arbitrarily large parameter. Okay, so that's a weak measurement. A weak value then is just the mean value of a weak measurement. Now that in itself is a boring statement, because if I just consider preparing a state psi, that the weak value is exactly the same as the strong value. It's just what quantum mechanics says for how to work out an average. Okay, so that's boring. To get something interesting, you have to consider post-selection. And this is what Aharonov, Albert, and Weidmann wrote about in 1988. So that is, what you do is you calculate the average of the weak measurement results from a sub-ensemble of your systems where a later measurement yielded a particular result from a strong measurement. So we could think of that as being where a later measurement reveals the state to be phi. Okay, but it's just a strong measurement for which this is the particular eigenstate that you get, and then you keep those elements of your ensemble in order to calculate the value. So when you do that, you find, and so this is not a definition, this is just what happens when you do the calculation, is that the weak value pre-selected on that preparation and post-selected on that final outcome, the average value of the weak measurements you made in the middle is given by this expression here. Which is a little bit different from what you usually see in quantum mechanics. And the interesting thing about it is that this weak value here can lie outside the range of the eigenvalues of the observable that you're measuring. And this is something that you can do, verify experimentally, and it was in fact done not long after the original AAV paper. And this would never happen, of course, for a strong measurement in the middle here between the two measurements, and it's not something that happens in for classical theories. Okay, so that's what a weak value is. Now let's think about a classical physicist, a way that a classical physicist might go about measuring the drift velocity, for example, for an ensemble of particles at a particular point. So one way they could do that, obviously they could just go into that point and wait, and if there's a particle there, measure its velocity. But another way they could consider doing it would be to just make a measurement. So we've got a particle, make a measurement of its velocity, okay, and then post-select on finding subsequently that the position was x. Okay? Now, in the quantum case, if you were to do this, then of course measuring the velocity, like if I take this as my definition of my velocity operator, which makes sense, that's going to completely disturb the particle's state, in particular the particle's position, because this is usually going to be the momentum, which is not going to be simultaneously measurable. So if you were in the situation of being an experimentalist like this, knowing that your first measurement was going to upset the result of the second measurement, the obvious thing to do, I would propose, would be to make sure that the first measurement here is a weak one. Okay, so you just weakly measure the velocity, but then post-select on finding the particle at the position for which you're interested in that drift velocity. Another way to look at that, it turns out this is exactly the same, is saying that you could make a weak measurement of the position, and then a short time later, tau, make a strong measurement of the position, and just subtract these two and divide by tau. And in the limit that tau goes to zero, that's exactly the same as this expression here. So you can think of either way. Yeah?
So a couple slides ago, you motivated weak values by saying that they were operationally meaningful.
Yeah, I might have said something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if you can defend that statement. If I say I'm skeptical that they're really operational, they have a strong operational meaning.
Well, what did I say? I say that they provide the best operational definition of concepts. What I mean is that, here's a way you can go out and measure it. That's what I mean by an operational definition of concepts. So you could say, a concept is the velocity of a particle at a point, for example. What does that mean, quantum mechanical? Well, here's an operational meaning for that concept. Go out and make a weak measurement of the velocity and post-select on getting the position and then doing the average.
How standard quantum mechanics gives rise to it? You wrote down the BODM.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So how is it that operational quantum mechanics cannot define the concept?
Well, no, and the weak values is not going outside standard quantum theory at all. It's just going outside the mindset, perhaps, of... Okay, I guess I did say that orthodox quantum mechanics cannot define it. So maybe that's not quite what I mean to say here. But I guess they're things that are not straightforwardly defined in orthodox quantum theory. Is that...
How about traditionally?
Traditionally defined. Okay, all right. Yep. Does that answer? Does that help?
Partly. So as you point out, you can, the weak value is something that you compute from statistics, from expectation values, right? You do your experiment, you do a lot, and then you sort of, you backtrack out. It's like, what value would this have if it had been defined? And you end up with something that's outside, potentially, the range of the eigenvalues. So
yes.
You have the weak value of a probability be 17.
Yes.
And so that makes me wonder, this is just a number I defined. Why should I think of this as really being related to the probability that I was trying to define in the first place when it takes the value of 17?
Well, because what you find is surprisingly, you could say all these things are, that it has so many counterintuitive properties that I believe it's worthless. But on the other hand, there is a calculus, if you like, of weak values, which, they're not just completely arbitrary numbers. So that there's a certain logic to them. when you're solving. So even though you get apparently ridiculous things like a probability of minus one, perhaps, or maybe probability is the wrong word to use, but you know, a particle number of minus one in a certain box, okay? Nevertheless, what you find is if you add up the total particle numbers in all the boxes, given that you started with one particle, you get minus one, one, and one, and so the total comes out to be one, which is the number of particles you started with. So you get, you know, there's a certain logic to them. You can argue about whether they give any insight or not. All I can say is that, you know, there is a, I guess I wrote this phrase I actually put, because the first time I gave this talk was to in a workshop dedicated to weak values. You can delete that if you like. But the point is that certainly there is a history of applying the concept of weak values to difficult situations in quantum mechanics. And all I'm saying is that, yeah, this work is in that tradition. You don't have to like it, but I'm saying this is a way you can operationally define something, and let's just take that operational definition and see where it leads. Okay, so where it leads is exactly where we're getting to, is that if you evaluate this, what you find is that it's exactly equal to the standard Bohmian expression for the velocity. Okay, so that's really one of the main results of, which has probably not surprised anyone given where it was leading. So an important point I'll come back to is that this works. You get this expression, or the two methods, the operational definition by weak values and the standard Bohmian definition, they agree only because the Hamiltonian which is appearing here is at most quadratic in the variables conjugate to the hidden variables. Okay, so here my hidden variables are the positions x. So it works, this whole thing works, only because the Hamiltonians that I deal with are in most quadratic in momentum. Okay, and I'll come back to that, as I said. All right, so what have we actually got to? Well, the way I'd like to say it is that you can imagine a naive experimentalist knowing that, you know, in general measurements disturb systems, but it is possible to make, you know, imprecise measurements that don't disturb systems so much. And in fact, you can make weak measurements which hardly disturb them at all. Could plausibly be led to, you know, this method of constructing the possible paths of particles. So an experimentalist, naive experimentalist, believing that particles must have paths, right? Knowing that, nevertheless, measurements disturb systems, could come up with this concept that, oh, well, what I should do is clearly measure the velocity weakly, then post-select on finding the particle at any particular position I'm interested in, and then I can go and reconstruct the paths. Okay? So, of course, I'm not saying that you can go out experimentally and follow a single path of a Bohmian particle. Okay, that's something which is not allowed in... that's just not going to happen, okay? What you can do, though, is, going back to my picture here, you could imagine doing this experiment over and over again. Every particle you get, you know, a tiny piece of data, which, so let's say we were considering some particular point right here, okay, at some particular time. You would have to do the experiment many, many times just to get the average, which will tell you the velocity of the particle at that point. Okay? Of course, when you say, you know, you post-select on getting the particle at a particular point and throw the rest of your ensemble away, of course you don't have to throw it away in the sense that, well, when the particle was somewhere else, well, you use that data for calculating the velocity field at that point. But anyway, you do this many, many times, and in principle you could then connect the, you know, you've got a velocity, you propagate the particle further, you then, you know, work out its velocity at the next point it's gone to. In principle, you could reconstruct this picture from experimental data. That's
Howard.
Yep.
Can you show me again just how you get that equation from the weak value equation in the previous slide?
I guess there's just a little bit of algebra, but this is the velocity operator.
Yes.
So I put that into this formula here. So the velocity operator goes in there. Phi is going to turn into x. And psi is psi, and I work that all through, and it just comes out equal to that. So in fact, there it is. I mean, So one thing which I've done, which makes it look a little different from what I had before, is if these were scalar particles, then I can just cross out that okay, and then it'll look like the expression I had before. Okay, but I put that in because then this expression becomes valid even when this contains extra degrees of freedom. Yes?
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, is there any way to connect this with Wigner functions?
With Wigner
functions, which is sort of a similar concept we're trying to talk about at the same time.
Yeah, there is some connections, I think, with... there's a direct connection, not so much with Wigner functions, but with some other function I can't remember the name of, which which has a lot of similar properties. But yeah, I mean, it's a right sort of idea. You could imagine this as a way to define phase-based probabilities or something. And yes, you can do that, and it does lead somewhere sensible, but I think it's not to the Wigner function. Okay. Okay, so something which I glossed over was that this little word here in brackets, I don't know if anybody noticed that, but strictly, you know, what I've said was this naive experimentalist, which I talked about, to reconstruct those paths would have to believe in determinism, okay? Because if you think about it, there's an awful lot of noise in every measurement that you make of velocity. You get, in fact, because you're making it weakly, it's a very imprecise measurement. There's a you know, arbitrarily large amount of noise on it. So if there was any noise in your ensemble in the velocity at this particular point, then there's no way you'd see it from your average, because you have to average over so much noise anyway. So in other words, to actually get these, so it would be masking the variations in the actual velocities of the Bohmian positions. And of course, there are theories such as Nelson's stochastic mechanics, which is like Bohmian mechanics, which has noise in the velocity. So these are conceivable things. So you have to assume determinism then for this naive experimental way, or whatever, whichever way driving it by this method, you'd have to assume that this is actually a deterministic velocity and not just the mean velocity, which is all you would, in a sense, be entitled to assume from your experiment. So I'm just pointing out that is a necessary assumption in this. Okay, how am I going for time?
You've got about another 15 minutes or
less. Okay, all right, so so weak values in Bohmian kinematics is a very short section. First, what do I mean by kinematics? Well, I don't know if I'm using it quite correctly, but basically dynamics was the law of motion. Because it's first order in time, in Bohmian mechanics, the kinematics is just the position, the configuration. So what do I want to say about that configuration? Well, the point is, you know, is it necessary? Surely, another assumption that I've made is that the kinematics in my problem is the position of the particles. And surprisingly, that's perhaps not a necessary assumption to make. And the reason is that first thing, there are a number of things. If I've already made the assumptions that I've written or put up here, okay, that already limits me in many ways. So if I'm going to consider deterministic theories only, then I have to consider some observable that has a continuous spectrum. And so that's a statement by Boob. But of course, this doesn't mean I have to consider position. I could consider momentum. But the interesting thing is that if you take this weak valued velocity as the rule for giving me a velocity, then that rules out replacing position by momentum. And the reason for that is that the Hamiltonian, of course, is not at most quadratic in the variable conjugate to momentum. That is to say, Hamiltonians are not quadratic in general in position. Okay? And so examples for that are, you know, Coulomb potential, that's not quadratic in position. In quantum field theory, the gluon field has a cubic Hamiltonian, that's not... that's beyond quadratic, etc. So what this means is that, thinking again about naive experimentalists, let's say that experimentalist thought, oh, well, maybe position is the real thing, you know, and what I have to do is look at how the positions are changing. So that experimentalist could go out and operationally measure, you know, a velocity field for momentum in momentum space, and that experimentalist could go out and measure, you know, actually do measure the momentum and see how that probability distribution is changing. And what that experimentalist would find is that the evolution of this in time is incompatible with this measured velocity that he did. Whereas it would have been compatible if this was position. So In other words, what I'm arguing is that the kinematics X is actually singled out by the dynamics in Bohmian mechanics if you take this as being the definition, which I put up as being the definition for the velocity field. Yeah?
Yep.
P is momentum.
Right, no, but what I'm saying, suppose the experiment goes out of measured position and wants to figure out whether the distribution is compatible with the naively determined velocity field over x.
Yep.
Then I thought you said earlier that only if the Hamiltonian is quadratic will you get this coincidence.
That's right. That's right. Quadratic in the variable conjugate to x. No, because Hamiltonians are quadratic in the variable conjugate to x.
But I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Right, got it.
Okay.
Thanks.
But they're not, because p squared is the first order approximation to the relativistic thing.
No, it's not. Well, I'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Okay, I want to get on to probability now. So what I've said is that, just going back, so Bohmian mechanics reproduces of all of orthodox quantum theory, given the kinematics X, this dynamics, and the probability assignment, which is what standard quantum theory tells us. But there's a curious thing here. Why should psi appear here and here? You know, why should the probability have anything to do with the dynamics? Why should we have this dual role? And I think to address this question, you really have to get to a deeper question, which is what is probability? And so for this one, I actually like the radical Bayesian answer, which is that to start with, probability is not real.
Wow.
Yes, I've learned something.
I'm flattered.
Okay, so probability... doesn't follow. Now, so what is probability then if it's not real? It's an expression of an observer's belief. So the probability of X at time t0 is an expression of an observer's belief about X at time t0. Okay. So this thing, and moreover, this thing is what I'll call, that's the prior probability distribution, or just prior for short. So if probability is just an expression of an observer's beliefs, then how come you get objective probabilities in orthodox quantum theory? That's obviously a big question. So I think this is a good answer. I don't know what other people think of it, but that what we should apply is Jain's principle of indifference. And I think this is a reasonable statement, that if the statement of a statistical problem is invariant under some transformation, then choose a prior that respects this indifference. Okay, so how does that possibly apply in this situation here? I'd say it's because, so basically, what, you know, how have we specified the problem? Well, you know, we have an unknown position at time t0, and we have a known wave function in the universe at time t0. Okay. There's no particular significance to this time t0. Okay. There's, you know, I could say it was a million years ago at the beginning of the universe, or, you know, just before you started your experiment. Okay, that's not part of the specification of the problem. So therefore, what I should do is choose a prior that respects this indifference. Okay, choose a prior that's covariant with respect to translation in time. That is, I should choose a prior that satisfies this equation here. And then, so I just found out this actual proof that Ward talked about just a few hours ago, I was lucky to learn about tomorrow, that if you require that the prior be a function of, or be proportional to a function of the, you know, at position x, the wave function at position x, and its derivatives, okay, then you can prove that the unique solution to this equation is the standard quantum mechanical prior. The standard Bohmian mechanical prior, we might say. So I think that's, you know, I mean, you might want to have something, an even stronger theorem, but I mean, I think that's a good start to have, pardon me, for justifying why this prior is a special thing to have. Okay, so some more comments about priors and prior and posterior distributions. is that, okay, so going back to this example, we have just an observer and a system. So when I wrote that before, it was as if the observer completely knew her own configuration, X naught. And of course, that amount of self-knowledge is not realistic, but it's not really required to get this to get an effective pure state, if that's what orthodox quantum theory would say you have as well. Okay, so I didn't. Yeah, that was just an aside. Really, the point is that even if it's not the case that an observer would really know the precise positions of all the Bohmian variables that make up that observer, okay, nevertheless, it is the case that observers are going to know something about Bohmian variables just by opening their eyes and looking around at the universe. Okay, so one's knowledge is not going to be equal to the prior distribution. So in Bohmian mechanics, the probability distribution for x at time t is not equal to this expression in terms of the wave function. It is not given by the universal wave function. Okay, that, I would argue, is only a prior distribution. Okay, that's what you should choose as your prior. But of course, that's not at all what the probability is. Okay, everyone has their own probability because everybody knows different things, but none of them are going to be equal to this. Okay, we'd have to imagine a completely innocent observer who hasn't opened her eyes or anything yet to imagine someone who would actually have this right-hand side as her probability distribution. So, yeah, I think this is more or less saying just what I was saying before. So as soon as you open your eyes, you collapse from this prior to something much sharper. Just based on looking at the condition of on the position of things relative to you, etc. So I wanted to emphasize that this collapse, which I'm talking about, is of course not nothing to do with, but is not at all the same as the collapse of the wave function in some versions of quantum theory. Okay, the universal wave function does not change. It maybe changes unitarily. It certainly never undergoes any collapse by any observer's observations. So the collapse here is just the usual classical epistemic or psychological collapse, based on in knowledge based on obtaining new information. So to me, I think the message is that in Bohmian mechanics, one should not think of this as being a quantum state at all. Okay, that it's playing a quite different role from this thing, which behaves like a quantum state in all the usual ways as in orthodox quantum theory. But this thing, it never collapses. It doesn't change when I obtain new information. So I don't think of this as a quantum state at all. What do I think it is? I think a better term for it would be guiding function, okay? In the sense that it's the essential constituent in the law of motion for the Bohmian particles. So to sum it up, I guess this is the way I like to think of it. Bohmian mechanics is that the probability distribution for the positions is epistemic. There's an actual position, which is ontic, and psi of t for the universe is gnomic, which means a law-like sort of object. And I'll have more to say about that in a minute.
You had Hamiltonians in your equations too. Would the Hamiltonian be gnomic?
Yeah, I guess the Hamiltonian would be gnomic as well, yeah.
Harold, you've got about 5 minutes.
Yep, okay. Well, that's good. So I'm up to the last section. So... So some remaining problems. So first of all, relativistic invariance. As Ward talked about, so this is also relevant to the question earlier about quadraticness of relativistic Hamiltonians. The point is that for gauge fields, they're always quadratic. For fermions, it's actually linear. It's actually subquadratic, if you want to say. For the Dirac field, if I use this model that Ward talked about of using Dirac's original particle hole formulation, then I only have to in fact deal with Hamiltonians that are linear in the variable conjugate to position, and so the whole thing goes through quite nicely. Nevertheless, just getting back to the general question of relativistic invariance, that there is a problem that like all hidden variable models or interpretations, Bohmian mechanics requires a preferred foliation of space-time. But of course, that doesn't actually allow us, the theory doesn't allow us to find out what that preferred foliation is, and that is definitely unsatisfying. Okay? So all I can say about that is perhaps when we have a correct quantum theory of space-time, that problem will disappear because maybe there is a preferred foliation. That's obviously complete speculation. A bit more about gnomic versus epistemic. So this is the question that Rob always comes back to me with, you know, if these things are so different, if the guiding field for the universe is gnomic, but these quantum states for subsystems are epistemic, how come they're represented by the same sort of mathematical object? That's how come they're represented by vector and Hilbert space? So again, speculation, perhaps it'll be that when we have a theory of everything, that will specify a unique psi here, and when we do have a unique psi, it'll probably also allow us to reformulate the law of motion in a way that looks much less like, you know, something involving a quantum state. And so just for example, if psi is, let's say, assume it's a unique solution to, this is, I guess you could think of as being the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So if it's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian of the universe, then you could re-express the Brownian law of motion in this equation here, which again doesn't actually directly involve any quantum states at all, and so arguably looks more like, you know, a plausible law of motion which has nothing to do with quantum states. Or another possibility, pure speculation, is that maybe it's possible to show that almost every wave function in the universe you write down might be compatible with experience. So maybe we don't have to worry about where this psi comes from, how come, you know, this particular thing. Maybe anyone will do, in which case, if that's the case, again, it might be possible to reformulate the law of motion in a way that looks, you know, less like something to do with a quantum state. Okay, and then this is my final final speculation, is that if you adopt this way of thinking, I think it opens up a whole completely different way of thinking about theory space than perspectives based on quantum information, for example. I don't know whether it would lead anywhere useful, but at least you can pose these questions. If I just think about some large dimensional vector x, and some guiding function, okay, nothing to do with quantum mechanics necessarily, but just some guiding function on that configuration space and some law of motion, which is local in configuration space in some sense, you know, what more do you have to put into the theory to derive the sort of things that we come across in the world? So at the most basic sense, I think what you would have to need is some concept of locality in a lower dimensional space, like a three-dimensional space. So something like signal locality, so that you can get, you know, subsystems, complex structures, you know, observers that can actually understand and interact with the world. That's an incredibly difficult question to answer, I'm sure, but in a sense, that's probably the first thing you have to answer. Other questions are, does this relate to Eric's talk this morning? You know, what else do you have to put in there to ensure that you would get intrinsic unpredictability? So, in other words, to get a fundamental distinction between epistemic and ontic states in the theory. What else? What do you need to get well-motivated priors, despite having intrinsic unpredictability, like the one that arose in Bohmian mechanics? Again, I think it's interesting to say, what's necessary for the fact that you get this notion of an operational state, which is different both from epistemic state and ontic state. Emerging out of the theory. Violation of local causality is obviously something that happens in quantum mechanics, and is it generic? Probably. And then the final thing is, this nice fact that you sort of have this self-consistent singling in Bohmian mechanics, singling out of the true kinematics, if you like, and dynamics of the theory from the operational considerations I've been talking about. Is that something that is going to naturally happen, or is that a very constrained thing? And so I guess the hope might be that, you know, this could, maybe you can show some list of these is sufficient to you know, get quantum mechanics as the only possible theory which satisfies these. Or maybe we could even come up with different sort of theories which could then be tested against quantum mechanics. But that's all extremely speculative. And I'll just finish with my summary. So the basic result was that the probability current in configuration space has a natural operational definition using weak measurements. Secondly, that this operational definition agrees with the standard expression. And so as a consequence, that the possible Bohmian trajectories of the hidden variable X can be determined by naive experimentalists assuming, with only making the assumption that the interpretation is deterministic. Okay. Interestingly, that adopting this naively observable velocity of the hidden variables in general, without assuming that the positions must be the hidden variables, what you get is that the asymmetry between the configuration and the conjugate momenta in physical Hamiltonian singles out the former. That is, that if the trajectories have to be compatible with the experimentally observed evolution of the probability distribution, then the hidden variable must be the configuration x, not, for example, a momentum or some linear combination of the position and momentum, as you might need. Okay, and then lastly, I talked about the role of Bayesian probability theory in Bohmian mechanics, and I think that it's a good justification for the priors that we use in Bohmian mechanics if we apply Jane's principle of indifference to the time at which we're defining these priors to apply to. And then, of course, I ended with some what seemed to me to be interesting open questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. I'm afraid we're out of time for questions, but since Howard had adopted the convention of having the speculative parts of his talk in blue, I'd like to point out that the cool bar I mentioned before is called blue, so it's obviously the ideal place to continue practice speculation. But thank you, Howard. Okay, so...